Nothing you could do about it anyway. She's gone missing, little girl. When? How? A few hours ago, ran off by the looks. Christ almighty, how the bloody hell did that happen? No idea. Well, what are they doing about it? They're looking. Let me help, I can't just sit here. The expression on Lynch's face was reply enough. Oh, for crying out loud, said Tom. Where am I likely to get to? I'll let you know if I hear anything, mate. Best I can do. With another metallic clang, he was gone. In the darkness, Tom's thoughts turned to Lucy, always curious to explore her surroundings, never afraid of the dark. Perhaps he should have taught her to be fearful. He had failed to prepare her for life beyond Janus. Then another thought came to him. Where was Isabel? What was she capable of in her current state? He prayed she hadn't taken things into her own hands. Thank Christ it wasn't winter. Vern and Nucky could feel the coolness setting in as midnight approached. The kid was wearing a cotton dress and a pair of sandals. At least in January she had a chance of making it through the night. In August she'd have been blue with cold by now. No point searching at this hour. Sun would be up not long after five, better to have people fresh and alert when the light was on their side. Spread the word, he said as he met Garson at the end of the road. We're calling it off for tonight. Get everyone to the station at first light and we'll start again. It was 1 a.m, but he needed to clear his head. He set off on the familiar route of his evening walk, still carrying his lantern, which took a swing in the dark with each of his steps. In the little cottage, Hannah prayed. Keep us safe, Lord. Protect her and save her. You've saved her before. Hannah worried. Perhaps Grace had used up her share of miracles. And then she soothed herself. It didn't take a miracle for a child to survive a single night here. She just needed to avoid bad luck. That was a different thing altogether. But that thought was pushed aside by more panicked, more urgent fear. Exhausted, a thought came to her with a twisted clarity. Perhaps God didn't want Grace to be with her. Perhaps she was to blame for everything. She waited and prayed and made a solemn pact with God. There's a kicking at the door of Hannah's house. Though the lights are off, she's still wide awake and springs up to open it. Before her stands Sergeant Nucky, with Grace's body in his arms, her limbs floppy. Oh, dear Lord, Hannah lunges for her. Her eyes are fixed on the girl, not the man, so she doesn't see that he's smiling. Almost tripped over her down the point, fast asleep, he says. She's got 9 lives, this one, that's for sure. And though he's grinning, there's a tear in his eye as he recalls the weight of the son he couldn't save decades before. Hannah barely registers these words as she hugs her daughter, who sleeps on in her arms. That night, Hannah laid Grace beside her in a bed, listening to her every breath, watching every turn of the head or kick of her foot. But the relief of feeling her daughter's warm body was overshadowed by a darker knowing. The first sound of rain, like gravel scattered on the tin roof, carried Hannah back to her wedding day, to a time of leaking ceilings and buckets in their humble cottage and love and hope. Above all, hope. Frank, with his smile and his cheerfulness no matter what the day brought. She wanted Grace to have that. She wanted her daughter to be a happy little girl. And she prayed to God for the courage and strength to do the things needed to allow it. When the thunder woke the child, she looked sleepily at Hannah and snuggled in closer to her before returning to her dreams, leaving her mother to weep silently, remembering her vow. The black house spider has returned to its web in the corner of Tom's cell and is going over and over the higgledy-piggledy threads, setting the shape in order to a design which only it can know. Why the silk must be in this particular place, this particular tension or angle, comes out at night to repair its web, a funnel of fibers that accumulate dust and form haphazard patterns. It is weaving its arbitrary world, always trying to mend, never abandoning its web unless forced. Lucy is safe. The relief fills Tom's body. But there is still no word from Isabel, no sign that she has forgiven him or that she ever will. The helplessness he felt at being unable to do anything for Lucy now strengthens his resolve to do what he can for his wife. It is the one freedom left to him. If he is going to have to live his life without her, somehow it makes it easier to let go, to let things take their course. His mind wanders into memory. the whoomph of the oil vapour igniting into brilliance at the touch of his match, the rainbows thrown by the prisms, the oceans spreading themselves before him about Janus like a secret gift. If Tom is to take his leave of the world, he wants to remember the beauty of it, not just the suffering. The breaths of Lucy, who trusted two strangers, bonding with their hearts like a molecule. And Isabel, the old Isabel, who lit the way for him back into life after all the years of death. A light rain wafts a steam of forest scents into his cell. The earth, the wet wood, the pungent smell of banksias with their flowers like big feathery acorns. It occurs to him that there are different versions of himself to farewell. The abandoned 8-year-old, the delusional soldier who hovered somewhere in hell, the lightkeeper who dared leave his heart undefended. Like Russian dolls, these lives sit within him. The forest sings to him, the rain tapping on the leaves, dripping into the puddles, the kookaburras laughing like madmen at some joke beyond human comprehension. He has a sensation of being part of a connected whole, of being enough. Another day or another decade will not change this. He is embraced by nature, which is waiting ultimately to receive him, to reorganize his atoms into another shape. The rain is falling more heavily, and in the distance thunder grumbles at being left behind by the lightning. Chapter 34. The Addicotts lived in a house which, but for a few yards of seagrass, would have been paddling its toes in the ocean. The timber and brick were kept in good order by Ralph, and Hilda coaxed a small garden from the sandy soil at the back. Zinnias and dahlias, as garish as dancing girls, bordered a trail to a little aviary in which finches chirped gaily, to the puzzlement of the native birds. The smell of marmalade drifted through the windows and met Ralph as he trudged up the front path the day after Lucy had been found. As he took his cap off in the hallway, Hilda rushed to intercept him, the wooden spoon in her hand glistening like an orange lollipop. She put a finger to her lips and led him to the kitchen.
"In the lounge room," she whispered, eyes wide. "Isabel Sherborne. She's been waiting for you."
Ralph shook his head.
"World's gone bloody haywire." "What does she want?" "That's the trouble, I reckon. She can't make up her mind what she wants."
The small, tidy lounge room of the sea captain was decorated not with ships in bottles or scale models of men of war, but icons. The archangels Michael and Raphael, Madonna and Child, and numerous saints stared at any visitors with stern calm from their place in eternity. The glass of water beside Isabel was almost empty. Her eyes were fixed on an angel, his sword and shield in hand, poised over a serpent at his feet. Heavy clouds dimmed the room so that the painting seemed faint pools of gold hovering in darkness. She didn't notice Ralph come in, and he watched her for a while before saying,
"That was the first one I got. I fished a Russian sailor out of the drink, near Sevastopol, 40-odd years ago. Gave it to me as a thank you."
He spoke slowly, pausing now and then. "I picked up the others along the way in my merchant marine days," he gave a chuckle. "I'm hardly the Holy Joe sort, and I couldn't tell you the first thing about painting, but there's something about this lot that makes them talk back to you. Hilda says they keep her company when I'm away." He put his hands in his pockets and nodded towards the picture Isabel was looking at.
"I've bent that fella's ear in my time, I can tell you. Archangel Michael. There he is with his sword in his hand, but he's got his shield half raised too. Like he's still making up his mind about something."
The room fell silent, and the wind seemed to rattle the windows more urgently, demanding Isabel's attention. All the way to the horizon the waves thrashed in chaos, and the sky began to smudge with another approaching shower. Her mind was thrust back to Janus, back to the vast emptiness, back to Tom. She started to cry in great sobs like waves, washing her back onto a familiar shore at last. Ralph sat down beside her and held her hand. She wept and he sat. Nothing at all was said for a good half hour. Finally, Isabel ventured.
"Lucy ran away last night because of me, Ralph.
trying to find me. She could have died. Oh, Ralph, it's all such a mess. I can't talk to Mum and Dad about it. Still, the old man stayed silent, holding Isabel's hand, looking at the fingernails bitten to the quick. He nodded his head slowly, just a touch. She's alive, and she's safe. I only ever wanted her to be safe, Ralph. From the moment she arrived on Janus, I wanted to do what was best. She needed us, and we needed her. She paused. I needed her. When she just appeared out of nowhere, it was a miracle, Ralph. I was sure she was meant to be with us. It was so crystal clear. A little baby had lost her parents. We had lost a little baby. I love her so much. She blew her nose. Out there. Ralph, you're one of the only people in the world who knows what it's like on Janus. One of the only people can imagine. But even you've never waved the boat off, stood on that jetty and heard the sound of the engine die away, watched the boat get smaller and smaller. You don't know what it's like to say goodbye to the world for years at a time. Janus was real. Lucy was real. Everything else was just make-believe. By the time we found out about Hannah Roenfeld, oh, it was too late then, Ralph. I just didn't have it in me to give Lucy up. I couldn't do that to her. The old man sat, breathing slowly and deeply, nodding now and again. He resisted any urge to question or contradict her. Keeping silent was the best way to help her, to help everyone. We were such a happy family. And then when the police came to the island, when I heard what Tom had done, nothing felt safe. Nowhere was safe. Not even inside myself was safe. I was so hurt and so angry and terrified. Nothing made sense from the moment the policeman told me about the rattle. She looked at him. What have I done? The question wasn't rhetorical. She was searching for a mirror, something to show her what she could not see. Can't say that concerns me as much as what you're going to do now. There's nothing I can do. Everything's ruined. There's no point in anything anymore. That man loves you, you know. That's got to be worth something. But what about Lucy? She's my daughter, Ralph. She searched for a way to explain. Can you imagine asking Hilda to give away one of her children? This isn't giving away. This is giving back, Isabel. But wasn't Lucy given to us? Isn't that what God was asking of us? Maybe he was asking you to look after her. And you did. And maybe now he's asking you to let someone else do that. He puffed out a breath. Hell, I'm not a priest. What do I know about God? But I do know that there's a man about to give up everything, everything, to protect you. Do you think that's right? You saw what happened yesterday. You know how desperate Lucy is. She needs me, Ralph. How could I explain it to her? You can't expect her to understand, not at her age. Sometimes life turns out hard, Isabel. Sometimes it just bites right through you. And sometimes, just when you think it's done its worst, it comes back and takes another chunk. I thought it had done all it could do to me years ago. If you think things are bad now, they'll be a whole lot worse if you don't speak up for Tom. This is serious, Isabel. Lucy's young. She's got people who want to care for her and give her a good life. Tom's got no one. I never saw a man who less deserved to suffer than Tom Sherborne. Under the watchful gaze of saints and angels, Ralph continued. God knows what got into the pair of you out there. It's been lie upon lie, all with the best intentions, but it's gone far enough. Everything you've done to help Lucy has hurt someone else. Good God, of course I understand how hard it must be for you. But that Sprague's a nasty piece of work, and I wouldn't put anything past him. Tom's your husband,
for better or worse, in sickness and in health. Unless you want to see him in jail, or... He couldn't finish the sentence. I reckon this is your last chance. Where are you going? An hour later, Violet was alarmed at the state of her daughter. You've only just walked in the door. I'm going out, Ma. There's something I have to do. But it's bucketing down. Wait till it stops, at least. She gestured to a pile of clothes on the floor beside her. I've decided to go through some of the boys' things, some of their old shirts, their boots. They might be good to someone. I thought I could give them to the church. A quiver crept into her voice. But it would be nice to have some company while I sort them. I have to go to the police station now. What on earth for? Isabel looked at her mother, and for a moment almost dared tell her, but she said, I need to see Mr. Nucky. I'll be back later, she called behind her, heading down the passageway to the front door. As she opened it, she was startled by a silhouette in the doorway, about to ring the bell. The figure soaked with rain was Hannah Roenfeldt. Isabel stood speechless. On the doorstep, Hannah spoke quickly, keeping her eyes on a bowl of roses on the table behind Isabel, fearing that to look at her directly would make her change her mind. I've come to say something, just to say it and go. Don't ask me anything, please. She thought back to the vow she had made to God just hours ago. There was no reneging. She took a breath like a run-up. Anything could have happened to Grace last night. She was so desperate to see you. Thank God she was found before she came to any harm. She looked up. Can you have any idea what it feels like to see the daughter you conceived and carried? The daughter you bore and nursed, call someone else her mother? Her eyes darted to one side. But I have to accept it. However much it hurts, I can't put my happiness above hers. The baby I had, Grace, isn't coming back. I can see that now. The plain fact is, she can live without me, even if I can't live without her. I can't punish her for what happened. And I can't punish you for your husband's decisions. Isabel began to protest, but Hannah spoke over her, with her eyes fixed again on the roses, she said, I knew Frank to his very soul. Perhaps I only ever knew Grace very little. She looked Isabel in the eye. Grace loves you. Perhaps she belongs to you. With great effort, she pushed on to her next words. But I need to know that justice is done. If you swear to me now that this was all your husband's doing, swear on your life, then I'll let Grace come to live with you. No conscious thought went through Isabel's mind. It was by sheer reflex that she said, I swear. Hannah continued, as long as you give evidence against that man, as soon as he's safely locked away, Grace can come back to you. Suddenly she was in tears. Oh, God, help me, she said, and rushed away. Isabel is dazed. She runs over and over at what she has just heard, wondering whether she has made it up. But there are the wet footprints on the veranda, a trail of drops from Hannah Roenfeldt's furled umbrella. She looks through the fly-wire door so close up that the lightning seems to be divided into tiny squares. Then the thunder rolls in and shakes the roof. Thought you were going to the police station. The words crash into Isabel's thoughts, and for a moment she has no idea where she is. She turns and notices her mother. I thought you'd gone already. What happened? There's lightning. At least Lucy won't be frightened. Isabel catches herself thinking as the sky cracks open with a brilliant flash. From when she was a baby, Tom has taught the girl to respect, but not fear, the forces of nature. The lightning that might strike the light tower on Janus, the oceans that battered the island. She thinks of the reverence Lucy showed in the lantern room, not touching the instruments, keeping her fingers off the glass. She recalls an image of the child in Tom's arms, waving and laughing from up on the gallery to Isabel, the washing line on the ground. Once upon a time there was a lighthouse. How many of Lucy's stories started that way?
And there did be a storm, and the wind blew and blew, and the lightkeeper made the light shine, and Lucy did help him, and it was dark, but the lightkeeper wasn't scared because he had the magic light. Lucy's tortured face comes to her mind. She can keep her daughter, keep her safe and happy, and put all this behind them. She can love and cherish her and watch her grow. In a few years, the Tooth Fairy will spirit away Milk Teeth for threepence. And then gradually Lucy will get taller, and together they will talk about the world and about... She can keep her daughter, if... Curled in a ball in her bed, she sobs, "I want my daughter! Oh, Lucy, I can't bear it!" Hannah's declaration, Ralph's entreaty, her own false oath betraying Tom as surely as he ever betrayed her. Around and around like a merry-go-round of possibilities they whirl and jumble, pulling her with them, first in one direction, then another. She hears the words that have been spoken, but the one voice that is absent is Tom's, the man who now stands between her and Lucy, between Lucy and her mother. Unable to resist its call any longer, she edges to the drawer and takes out the letter. She opens the envelope slowly. "Izzy, love, I hope you're all right, keeping your strength up. I know your mum and dad will be taking good care of you. Sergeant Nucky's been good enough to let me write to you, but he'll be reading this before you do. I wish we could talk face to face. I'm not sure if or when I'll be able to speak to you again. You always imagine you'll get the chance to say what needs to be said to put things right. That's not always how it goes. I couldn't go on the way things were. I couldn't live with myself. I'm sorry than I'll ever be able to say for hurting you. We each get a little turn at life, and if this ends up being how my turn went, it will still have been worth it. My time should have been up years ago. To have met you when I thought life was over, and been loved by you. If I lived another 100 years, I couldn't ask for better than that. I've loved you as best as I know how, Iz, which isn't saying much. You're a wonderful girl, and you deserved someone a lot better than me. You're angry and hurt and nothing makes sense, and I know what that feels like. If you decide to wash your hands of me, I won't blame you. Perhaps when it comes to it, no one is just the worst thing they ever did. All I can do is to ask God and to ask you to forgive me for the harm I've caused, and to thank you for every day we spent together. Whatever you decide to do, I'll accept it, and I'll stand by your choice. I will always be your loving husband, Tom." As though it is a picture, not a note, Isabel traces her fingertip over the letters, following the steady lean, the graceful loops, as though that is how to make sense of the words. She imagines his long fingers on the pencil as it travelled across the page. Over and over, she traces Tom. The words somehow both foreign and familiar. Her mind wanders to the game they would play, where she would draw letters with her finger on his naked back for him to guess, and he would do the same on hers. But the recollection is swiftly countered by the memory of Lucy's touch, her baby's skin. She imagines Tom's hands again, this time as it wrote the notes to Hannah. Like a pendulum, her thoughts swing back and forward, between hatred and regret, between the man and the child. She lifts her hand from the paper and reads the letter again, this time trying to make out the meaning of the words on the page, hearing Tom's voice pronounce them. She reads it over and over, feeling as though her body is being rent in two, until finally, shaking with sobs, she makes her decision. Chapter 35. When it rains in Partageurs, the clouds hurl down water and soak the town to its very bones. Millennia of such deluges have brought forth the forests from the ancient loam. The sky darkens and the temperature plummets. Great gullies are carved across dirt roads, and flash floods make them impassable by motor cars. The rivers quicken, finally scenting the ocean from which they have so long been parted. They will not be stopped in their urgency to get back to it, to get home. The town goes quiet. The last few horses stand forlornly with their wagons as the rain drips off their blinkers, and bounces off the motor cars which far outnumber them these days. People stand under the wide verandas of the shops in the main street, arms folded, mouths turned down in grimaces of defeat. At the back of the schoolyard, a couple of tearaways stamp their feet in puddles. Women look in exasperation at washing not retrieved from lines, and cats slink through the nearest convenient doorway, meowing their disdain. The water rushes down the war memorial where the gold lettering is faded now. It springs off the church roof and through the mouth of a gargoyle, onto the new grave of Frank Roenfeldt. The rain transforms the living and the dead without preference. Lucy won't be frightened. The thought occurs in Tom's mind, too. He recalls the feeling in his chest, that strange shiver of wonder for the little girl, when she would face down the lightning and laugh. "Make it go bang, Dada," she would cry, and wait for the thunder to roll in.
"Bugger it," exclaimed Vernon Nucky. "We've sprung a bloody leak again."
The runoff from the hill above the station was rather more than a leak. Water was pouring into the back of the building, set lower than the front. Within hours, Tom's cell was 6 inches deep in water, entering from above and below. The house spider had abandoned its web for somewhere safer. Nucky appeared, keys in hand.
"Your lucky day, Sherborne."
Tom did not understand.
"Usually happens when it rains this much. Ceiling in this part tends to collapse. Perth's always saying they're going to fix it, but they just sent some cove to put a bit of flour and water glue on it, as far as I can see. Still, they get a bit dark with us if the prisoners cark it before trial. You'd better come up front for a while, till the cell drains."
He left the key unturned in the lock.
"You're not going to be stupid about this, are you?"
Tom looked at him squarely and said nothing.
"All right, out you come."
He followed Nucky to the front office, where the sergeant put one handcuff on his wrist and another around an exposed pipe.
"Not going to be flooded with customers as long as this holds out," he said to Harry Garstone.
He chuckled to himself at his pun.
"Ah, May McCackie, eat your heart out."
There was no sound except the rain, thundering down, turning every surface into a drum or a cymbal. The wind had fled, nothing outside moved except the water. Garstone set to with a mop and some towels, attempting to redeem the situation inside. Tom sat looking through the window at the road, imagining the view from the gallery at Janus now. The keeper would feel like he was in a cloud with the sudden air inversion. He watched the hands on the clock inch their way around the dial as if there were all the time in the world. Something caught his attention. A small figure was making its way towards the station. No raincoat or umbrella, arms folded and bent forward as though leaning on the rain. He recognized the outline instantly. Moments later, Isabel opened the door. She looked straight ahead as she made for the counter where Harry Garstone had stripped to the waist and was busy trying to mop up a puddle. Isabel began. Garstone turned to see who was speaking.
"I've got to see Sergeant Nucky."
The flustered constable, half naked and mop in hand, blushed. His eyes flicked towards Tom. Isabel followed his gaze and gasped. Tom jumped to his feet, but he could not move from the wall. He reached a hand to her as she searched his face, terrified.
"Izzy! Izzy, love!"
He strained at the handcuffs, stretching his arm to the very fingertips. She stood, crippled by fear and regret and shame, not daring to move. Suddenly her terror got the better of her, and she turned to dash out again. It was as though Tom's whole body had been brought back to life at the sight of her. The thought that she might vanish again was more than he could bear. He pulled again at the metal, this time with such force that he wrenched the pipe from the wall, sending water gushing high into the air.
"Tom!"
Isabel sobbed as he caught her in his arms.
"Oh, Tom!"
Her body shaking despite the strength of his hold.
"I've got to tell them, I've got to..."
"Shh, Izzy, shh. It's all right, darling, it's all right."
Sergeant Nucky appeared from his office.
"Garstone, what in the name of Christ..."
He stopped at the sight of Isabel in Tom's arms, the two of them soaking from the pipe's downpour.
"Mr. Nucky, it's not true. None of it's true," cried Isabel. Frank Rowenfelt was dead when the boat washed up. It was my idea to keep Lucy. I stopped him reporting the boat. It's my fault.
Tom was holding her tight, kissing the top of her head.
Shh, Izzy. Just leave things be.
He pulled away and held her shoulders as he bent his knees and looked straight into her eyes.
It's all right, sweetheart. Don't say any more.
Nucky shook his head slowly. Garstone had hastily replaced his tunic and was smoothing his hair into some sort of order.
Shall I arrest her, sir?
For once in your bloody life, show some sense, Constable. Get busy and fix the blinking pipe before we all drown. Nucky turned to the others who were staring intently at one another, their silence a language in itself. And as for you two, better come to my office.
Shame. To her surprise, it was shame Hannah felt more than anger when Sergeant Nucky visited her with the news of Isabel Sherborne's revelation. Her face burned as she thought back to the visit to Isabel just the previous day and to the bargain she had struck.
When?
When did she tell you this? She asked.
Yesterday.
What time yesterday?
Nucky was surprised by the question. What bloody difference could it make?
About 5 o'clock.
So it was after. Her voice died away.
After what?
Hannah blushed even deeper, humiliated at the thought that Isabel had refused her sacrifice and disgusted at having been lied to.
Nothing.
Thought you'd want to know.
Of course, of course.
She was concentrating not on the policeman but on a window pane. It needed cleaning. The whole house needed cleaning. She had hardly touched it for weeks. Her thoughts climbed this familiar trellis of housework, keeping her on safe territory, until she managed to haul them back.
So, where is she now?
She's on bail, at appearance. Hannah picked at a hangnail and a thumb.
What will happen to her?
She'll face trial alongside her husband.
She was lying all that time.
She made me believe. She shook her head, lost in another thought. Nucky took a breath.
All pretty rum business. Decent sort, Isabel Gray's mark was, before she went to Janus. Being out on that island didn't do her any good at all. Not sure it does anyone any good. After all, Sherborne only got the posting because Trimble Doherty did away with himself.
Hannah wasn't sure how to put the question.
How long will they go to prison for?
Nucky looked at her.
Rest of their lives?
The rest of their lives.
Oh, I'm not talking about the jail time. Those two will never be free now. They'll never get away from what's happened.
Neither will I, Sergeant.
Nucky sized her up and decided to take a chance.
Look, you don't get a military cross for being a coward. You don't get a bar to go with it unless you saved a lot of your side's lives by risking your own. Tom Sherborne's a decent man, I reckon. I'd go so far as to say a good man, Mrs. Rowenfelt. And Isabel's a good girl. 3 miscarriages she had out there with no one to help her. You don't go through the things those two have been through without being bent out of shape.
Hannah looked at him, her hands still waiting to see where he was going.
It's a god-awful shame to see a fellow like that in the position he's in, not to mention his wife.
What are you saying?
I'm not saying anything that won't occur to you in a few years' time. It'll be too late by then.
She turned her head a fraction as if to understand him better.
I'm just asking, is it really what you want? A trial? Prison? You've got your daughter back. There might be some other way.
Some other way?
Sprague will lose interest now that he's had to drop his murder malarkey. As long as this is still a part of Jerse matter, I've got some leeway. Maybe Captain Haslack could be persuaded to put in a word for him with the lights.
If you were minded to speak up for him too, ask for clemency.
Hannah's face reddened again and without warning she jumped to her feet. Words that had been building up for weeks, for years. Words Hannah didn't know were there burst from her.
I'm sick of this.
I'm sick of being pushed around, of having my life ruined by the whims of other people.
You have no idea what it's like to be in my position, Sergeant Nucky. How dare you come into my house and make such a suggestion? How bloody dare you?
I didn't mean to. Let me finish. I've had enough. Do you understand me?
Hannah was shouting now.
No one is ever going to tell me how to live my life again. First it's my father telling me who I can marry. Then it's the whole bloody town turning on Frank like a mob of savages. Then Gwen tries to convince me to give Grace back to Isabel Graysmark. And I agree. I actually agree.
Don't look so shocked. You don't know everything that goes on around here.
And it turns out the woman lied to my face. How dare you? How dare you to presume to tell me, to even to suggest to me that I should yet again put someone else first?
She pulled herself up straight. Get out of my house.
Now. Just go before I...
She picked up the nearest thing to hand, a cut glass vase. Throw this at you. Nucky was too slow in getting to his feet, and the vase caught him on the shoulder, ricocheting against the skirting board where it smashed in a dazzle of shards. Hannah stopped, not sure whether she was imagining what she'd done. She stared at him, waiting for a clue. He stood perfectly still, the curtain flat with the breeze, a flat blowfly buzzed against the flywire. A last fragment of glass gave a dull tinkle as it finally succumbed to gravity. After a long silence, Nucky said,
"Make you feel better?"
Still, Hannah's mouth was wide open. She'd never in her life hit anyone. She'd never really sworn. And she'd definitely never done either to a police officer.
"I've had a lot worse thrown at me."
Hannah looked at the floor.
"I apologize."
The policeman bent to pick up some of the bigger pieces of glass and put them on the table.
"Don't want the little one cutting her feet."
"She's at the river with her grandfather," muttered Hannah, gesturing vaguely towards the glass. She added, "I don't usually..." But the sentence trailed off.
"You've had enough, I know. Just as well it was me you threw it at, and not Sergeant Sprague."
He allowed himself a trace of a smile at the thought.
"I shouldn't have spoken like that. People do, sometimes. People have had less to contend with than you. We're not always in full control of our actions. I'd be out of a job if we were."
He picked up his hat.
"I'll leave you in peace. Let you think about things. There isn't a lot of time left. Once the magistrate gets here and sends him off to Albany, there's nothing I can do about it."
He walked through the door into the dazzle of daylight where the sun was burning the last of the clouds away from the east. Hannah fetched the dustpan and brush, her body moving without any apparent instruction. She swept up the shards of glass, checking carefully for any overlooked splinters. She took the dustpan into the kitchen and emptied it onto old newspaper, wrapping the glass safely and taking it outside to the rubbish bin. She thought of the story of Abraham and Isaac and how God had tested Abraham right to the limit to see whether he would surrender the thing dearest to him in the world. Only as the knife was poised above the child's neck did God direct him to a lesser sacrifice. She still had her daughter. She was about to go back inside when she caught the sight of the Cape gooseberry bush, and remembered that terrible day after Grace's return when her daughter had wedged herself behind it. As she sank to her knees on the grass and sobbed, the memory of a conversation with Frank floated into her awareness.
"But how? How can you just get over these things, darling?" she'd asked him. "You've had so much strife, but you're always happy. How do you do it?"
"I choose to," he said. "I can leave myself to rot in the past, spend my time hating people for what happened, like my father did, or I can forgive and forget. But it's not that easy."
He smiled that frank smile.
"Oh, but my treasure, it is so much less exhausting. You only have to forgive once. To resent, you have to do it all day, every day. You have to keep remembering all the bad things."
He laughed, pretending to wipe sweat from his brow.
"I would have to make a list, a very, very long list, and make sure that I hated the people on it the right amount. That I did a very proper job of hating, too. Very Teutonic." "No." His voice became sober. "We always have a choice, all of us."
Now she lay down on her belly in the grass, feeling the strength the sun sap hers. Exhausted, half aware of the bees and the scent of the dandelions beside her. Half aware of the sour sops under her fingers where the grass was overgrown. Finally she slept. Tom still feels the touch of Isabel's wet skin, even though the cell is now drained, his clothes dry, and his reunion with her yesterday evening just a memory. He wants it both to be real and to be an illusion. If it's real, his Izzy has come back to him as he prayed she would. If it's an illusion, he's still safe from the prospect of prison. Relief and dread mix in his gut, and he wonders if he will ever feel her touch again. In her bedroom, Violet Graysmark is weeping.
Oh, Bill, I just don't know what to think, what to do. Our little girl could go to jail. Oh, the pity of it.
We'll get through it, dear. She'll get through it too, somehow.
He does not mention his conversation with Vernon Nucky. Doesn't want to get her hopes up. But there might be the shadow of a chance. Isabel sits alone under the jacaranda. Her grief for Lucy is as strong as ever. A pain that has no location and no cure. Putting down the burden of the lies meant giving up the freedom of the dream. Pain on her mother's face, the hurt in her father's eyes, Lucy's distress. The memory of Tom handcuffed. She tries to fend off the army of images and imagines what prison will be like. Finally, she has no more strength. No more fight in her. Her life is just fragments that she will never be able to reunite. Her mind collapses under the weight of it, and her thoughts descend into a deep, black well, where shame and loss and fear begin to drown her. Septimus and his granddaughter are by the river watching the boats.
Tell you who used to be a good sailor. My Hannah. When she was little, she was good at everything as a little one, bright as a button. Always kept me on my toes, just like you. He tousled her hair. My saving grace you are.
No, I'm Lucy, she insists.
You were called Grace the day you were born.
But I want to be Lucy.
He eyes her up, taking the measure of her.
Tell you what. Let's do a business deal. We'll split the difference, and I'll call you Lucy Grace. Shake hands on it?
Hannah was awoken from her sleep on the grass by a shadow over her face. She opened her eyes to find Grace standing a few feet away, staring. Hannah sat up and smoothed her hair, disoriented.
Told you that'd get her attention, laughed Septimus.
Grace gave a faint smile. Hannah began to stand when Septimus said,
No, stay there. Now, Princess, why don't you sit on the grass and tell Hannah all about the boats? How many did you see?
The little girl hesitated.
Go on, remember how you counted them on your fingers?
She held up her hands. 6, she said, showing 5 fingers on one hand and 3 on the other before folding 2 of them down again. Septimus said,
I'll go and have a rummage in the kitchen and get her some cordial. You stay and tell her about the greedy seagull you saw with that big fish.
Grace sat on the grass, a few feet from Hannah. Her blonde hair shone in the sun. Hannah was caught. She wanted to tell her father about Sergeant Nucky's visit, ask his advice. But she had never seen Grace this ready to talk, to play, and couldn't bear to ruin the moment. Out of habit, she compared the child with her memory of her baby, trying to recapture her lost daughter. She stopped. We always have a choice. The words ran through her mind. Shall we make a daisy chain? She asked.
What's a daisy chain?
Hannah smiled.
Chain.
Yeah, we'll make you a crown,
she said, and started to pick the dandelions beside her. As she showed Grace how to pierce a stem with her thumbnail and thread the next stem through it, she watched her daughter's hands the way they moved. They were not the hands of her baby. They were the hands of a little girl she would have to get to know all over again, and who would have to get to know her too. We always have a choice. A lightness fills her chest as if a great breath has rushed through her. Chapter 36. As the sun dangled above the horizon at the end of the jetty at Partageurs, Tom stood waiting. He caught sight of Hannah approaching slowly. 6 months had passed since he had last seen her, and she seemed transformed, her face fuller, more relaxed. When she finally spoke, her voice was calm. "Well?"
"I wanted to say I'm sorry, and to thank you for what you did."
"I don't want your thanks," she said.
"If you hadn't spoken up for us, it would have been a lot more than 3 months of spent in Bunbury jail."
Tom said the last two words with difficulty. The syllables felt thick with shame.
"An Isabel suspended sentence. That was mostly thanks to you," my lawyer said.
Hannah looked off into the distance. "Sending her to jail wouldn't have fixed anything. Nor would keeping you there for years. What's done's done."
"All the same, it can't have been an easy decision for you."
"The first time I saw you, it was because you came to save me, when I was a complete stranger and you owed me nothing. That counts for something, I suppose. And I know that if you hadn't found my daughter, she would have died. I tried to remember that too." She paused. "I don't forgive you, either of you, being lied to like that. But I'm not going to get dragged under by the past. Look what happened to Frank because of people doing that." She stopped, twisting her wedding ring for a moment. "And the irony is, Frank would have been the first one to forgive you. He would have been the first one to speak in your defense, in defense of people who make mistakes. It was the only way I could honor him, doing what I knew he would have done." She looked at him, eyes glistening. "I loved that man." They stood in silence, looking out at the water. Eventually Tom spoke. "The years you missed with Lucy, we can never give him back. She's a wonderful little girl." Hannah's expression made him mad. "We'll never come near her again, I promise you." The words caught in his throat and he tried again. "I've got no right to ask anything, but if one day, maybe when she's grown up, she remembers us and asks about us, if you can bear to, tell her we loved her, even though we didn't have the right." Hannah stood, weighing something in her mind. "Her birthday's the 18th of February. You didn't know that, did you?"
"No." Tom's voice was quiet.
"And when she was born, she had the cord wrapped around her neck twice. And Frank. Frank used to sing her to sleep. You see, there are things I know about her that you don't."
"Yes," he nodded gently.
"I blame you. And I blame your wife. Of course I do." She looked straight at him. "I was so scared that my daughter might never love me. Love's what children do."
She turned her eyes to a dinghy nudging the jetty with each wave and frowned at a new thought. "No one ever mentions it around here, how Frank and Grace came to be in that boat in the first place. Not a soul ever apologized. Even my father doesn't like to talk about it. At least you've said you're sorry. Paid the price for what you did to him." After a while, she said,
"Where are you living?"
"In Albany. Ralph Addicott helped me find work at the harbour there when I got out 3 months ago now. Means I can be near my wife. The doctor said she needed complete rest. For the moment, she's better off in the nursing home where she can be properly cared for." He cleared his throat. "Best let you go. I hope life turns out well for you and for Grace."
"Goodbye," Hannah said, and made her way back down the jetty. The setting sun dipped the gum leaves in gold as Hannah walked up the path at her father's house to collect her daughter.
"This little piggy stayed at home," Septimus was saying,
giving his granddaughter's toe a wiggle as she sat on his knee on the veranda.
"Oh, look who's here, Lucy Grace. Mummy, where did you go?"
Hannah was struck anew by her daughter's version of Frank's smile, Frank's eyes of his fair hair. "Maybe I'll tell you one day, little one," she said, and kissed her lightly. "Shall we go home now? Can we come back to Grandad tomorrow?" Septimus laughed.
"You can visit Grandad any time you like, Princess. Any time you like."
Dr. Sumpton had been right. Given time, the little girl had gradually got used to her new, or perhaps it was her old, life. Hannah held out her arms and waited for her daughter to climb into them. Her own father smiled.
"That's the way, girlie. That's the way.
Come on, darling. Off we go." "I want to walk." Hannah put her down and the child allowed herself to be led out through the gate and along the road. Hannah kept her pace slow so Lucy Grace could keep up. "See the kookaburra?" she asked. "He looks like he's smiling, doesn't he?" The girl paid little attention until a machine gun burst of laughter came from the bird as they drew closer. She stopped in astonishment and watched the creature, which she had never seen so close up. Again, it rattled off its raucous call. "He's laughing. He must like you," said Hannah. "Or maybe it's going to rain. The cookers always laugh when the rain's coming. Can you make his sound?" "He goes like this," and she broke into a fair imitation of its call, which her mother had taught her decades ago. "Go on, you have a go at it." The girl could not manage the complicated call. "I'll be a seagull," she said, and came out with a pitch-perfect imitation of the bird she knew best, a shrill, harsh barracking. "Now you do it," she said, and Hannah laughed at her own unsuccessful attempts. "You'll have to teach me, sweetheart," she said, and the two of them walked on together. On the jetty, Tom thinks back to the first time he saw Partishers, and the last. Between them, Fitzgerald and Nucky had traded off charges and whittled down Sprague's kitchen sink. The lawyer had been eloquent in showing that the child-stealing charge wouldn't stand and that all related charges must therefore also fall. The guilty plea to the remaining administrative counts, tried in Partishers rather than Albany, could still have brought a severe penalty had Hannah not spoken articulately in their defence, urging clemency. Bunbury Jail, halfway up to Perth, was less brutal than Fremantle or Albany would have been. Now as the sun dissolves into the water, Tom is aware of a nagging reflex. Months after leaving Janus, his legs still prepare to climb the hundreds of stairs to light up. Instead, he sits on the end of the jetty, watching the last few gulls on the lilting water. He considers the world that has carried on without him, its stories unfolding, whether he is there to see them or not. Lucy is probably already tucked into bed. He imagines her face, left naked by sleep. He wonders what she looks like now, whether she dreams about her time on Janus, whether she misses her light. He thinks of Isabel, too, in her little iron bed in the nursing home, weeping for her daughter, for her old life. Time will bring it back, he promises her. He promises himself. She will mend. The train for Albany will be leaving in an hour. He will wait until dark to walk through town, back to the station. In the garden of the nursing home at Albany a few weeks later, Tom sat at one end of the wrought iron bench, Isabel at the other. The pink zinnias were past their best now, ragged and tinged with brown. Snails had started on the leaves of the asters, and their petals had been carried off in clumps by the southerly wind. "At least you're starting to fill out again, Tom. You looked so dreadful when I first saw you again. Are you managing all right?" Isabel's tone was concerned, though distant. "Don't worry about me. It's you we've got to concentrate on now." He watched a cricket settle on the arm of the bench and start up a chirrup. "They say you're all right to leave whenever you want, Is." She bowed her head and tucked a strand of hair behind an ear. "There's no going back, you know. There's no undoing what happened, what we've both been through," she said. Tom looked at her steadily, but she didn't meet his gaze as she murmured, "And besides, what's left?" Left of what? Of anything. What's left of our life? There's no going back on the lights, if that's what you mean. Isabel sighed sharply. It's not what I mean, Tom. She pulled a piece of honeysuckle from the old wall beside her and examined it. As she shredded a leaf, then another, the fine pieces fell in a jagged mosaic on her skirt. Losing Lucy, it's as if something's been amputated. Oh, I wish I could find the words to explain it. The words don't matter. He reached a hand to her, but she shrank away. Tell me you feel the same, she said. How does saying that make anything better, Is? She pushed the pieces into a neat pile. You don't even understand what I'm talking about, do you? He frowned, struggling, and she looked away at a billowing white cloud which threatened the sun. You're a hard man to know. Sometimes living with you is just lonely. He paused. What do you want me to say to that, Izzy? I wanted us to be happy. All of us. Lucy got under your skin, opened up your heart somehow, and it was wonderful to see. There was a long silence before expression changed with the return of memory. All that time, and I didn't know what you'd done. But every time you touched me, every time you... I had no idea you'd been keeping secrets. I tried to talk about it, Is. You wouldn't let me. She jumped to her feet, the fragments of leaves spiraling to the grass. I wanted to make you hurt, Tom, like you hurt me. Do you realize that? I wanted revenge. Haven't you got anything to say about that? I know you did, sweet. I know. But that time's over. What, so you forgive me just like that, like it's nothing? What else is there to do? You're my wife, Isabel. You mean you're stuck with me? I mean, I promised to spend my life with you. Still want to spend my life with you. Is, I've learned the hard way that to have any kind of a future, you've got to give up hope of ever changing your past. She turned away and pulled some more honeysuckle from its vine. What are we going to do? How are we going to live? I can't go on looking at you every day and resenting you for what you did, being ashamed of myself too. No, love, you can't. Everything's ruined. Nothing can ever be put right. Tom rested a hand on hers. We've put things right as well we can. That's all we can do. We have to live with the things the way they are now. She wandered along the path beside the grass, leaving Tom on the seat. After a full circuit of the lawn, she returned. I can't go back to Pardeshire's. I don't belong there anymore. She shook her head and watched the progress of the cloud. I don't know where I belong these days. Tom stood up and put his hand on her arm. You belong with me, Is. Doesn't matter where we are. Is that true anymore, Tom? She was holding the strand of honeysuckle, stroking the leaves absently. Tom plucked one of the creamy blooms from it. We used to eat these when we were kids. Did you? Eat them? He bit the narrow end of the flower and sucked a droplet of nectar from its base. You only taste it for a second, but it's worth it. He picked another and put it to her lips to bite. Chapter 37, Hopetown, 28th of August, 1950. There was nothing much in Hopetown now, except the long jetty that still whispered of the glory days, when the town served as support for the goldfields. The port itself had closed in 1936, a few years after Tom and Isabel had moved here. Tom's brother, Cecil, had outlived his father by barely a couple of years. And when he died, the money was enough to buy a farm outside the town. Their property was small by local standards, but still edged the coast for several miles. And the house stood on a ridge just inland, looking down over the sweep of the beach below. They lived a quiet life. They went into town occasionally. Farmhands helped with